Hello, everyone. Brittany Mangelson here. The episode that you are about to listen to is a pre-recorded event that we had at Salt Lake Community of Christ a few weeks ago. Our friend, Dr. Heidi Vaudry, who is a Latter-day Saint doctor in the area, came to our congregation to give a presentation on anxiety and depression. And at the very last minute, we decided to hook up a microphone on her caller and have her record it for the podcast. And so in her presentation, she had some slideshows that went along with what she was saying. And we are going to link those slideshows in the show notes and on the website so you can follow along for her presentation. And yeah, thank you for listening to Project Zion, and we will catch you later.
Welcome to the Project Zion podcast. This podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts Community of Christ offers for today's world.
My name is Heidi Vaudry. I'm a family nurse practitioner in Lehigh. I do have my doctorate, as Brittany mentioned, so technically I'm Dr. Vaudry, but I just really don't know what to do with that title. It feels kind of, I don't know, foreign. I've been a nurse for a really long time. Mental health is really near and dear to my heart. If you looked at my schedule today in clinic, I would say two-thirds of the patients that I saw, I addressed mental health issues with them. So I had no idea how much was managed in primary care until I went back to school. You kind of feel like, I'm the only person in the universe that's depressed, or the people that have those kind of problems go to see psychiatrists. Well, psychiatrists are few and far between, in case you've ever tried to access that kind of care. And so it boils down to good primary care. One of the things I love about being a nurse practitioner is that we learn how to take care of the whole person. We have a really holistic view of that, and I'm very interested in functional medicine, which looks at the root cause of why people are having this kind of dysfunction. One of the patients that I saw in clinic just today has significant eating disorders, and as we dug deeper, it stems back from sexual abuse that she experienced in childhood. So this caused changes in her brain chemistry and in her ability to manage stress, which is manifesting in an eating disorder. So rather than just throwing a medication at it, we're going to do some deeper exploration, work on therapy. Medication may be appropriate too, but I'm looking at the whole package and seeing how we can help her function. So the purpose of my discussion today is to teach you about your brain, to help you understand how your brain works, what a healthy brain looks like, and what happens when your brain chemistry gets a little bit off kilter, which happens in a lot of us. Utah we're number 5 in the nation for suicide. That's not something to be super proud of. Okay, so, and we'll talk a little bit more about why we think that is. And then we'll be talking about what the signs and symptoms and the physical and cognitive manifestations of depression are, not just sadness or feeling down or depressed, but beyond that. Then we'll talk about when you need to get help and what that help can look like in terms of both self-help and also professional help with either counseling or medication, those kinds of things. And then at the end, we'll wrap up with some spiritual care concepts and some resources. So without further ado, here we go. Let's start with a little bit of biology. In your brain, the cells that carry messages back and forth are not actually touching. There's a small gap called the synapse. And in order for one cell to talk to another cell, we have to have little chemical messengers that carry those messages across that gap. The ones that are most commonly talked about in mood are dopamine, serotonin, and norepinephrine. So those are the ones we're going to focus on today. I'll briefly mention some of the other ones that also have important roles, but those are the ones that we talk about the most and that most of the medications are aimed at. They carry both inhibition and excitation messages back and forth. For instance, dopamine and acetylcholine are antagonistic to each other. Dopamine helps you move and acetylcholine helps you slow down. So in people who have Parkinson's disease where there's a lack of dopamine, they don't have that movement push, the acetylcholine takes over and they have a hard time moving. Okay? All of these neurotransmitters affect your brain chemistry and your mood and those things, but they have many other effects on your body beyond that. And so it's important to understand how it affects your body and why you have other symptoms. Serotonin's a biggie. I'm sure you've heard of it. Serotonin regulates sleep. So one of the things that I assess when I'm talking to someone about their mood is, do you have a hard time falling asleep? Do you have a hard time staying asleep? Do you tend to wake up just totally out of the blue between 2 and 3 in the morning and you can't go back to sleep? Those are all indications of disruptions in the serotonin and melatonin cycle. You have a whole bunch of hormones in your body that fluctuate at predictable times throughout the day. Cortisol is your wake-up hormone that spikes in the morning then kind of trails off throughout the day. Melatonin and serotonin help you go to sleep and stay asleep, but if those are off-kilter, then you're going to have issues with that. Appetite's a big one. For some people, when their serotonin is low, they eat their feelings, so to speak. Other people feel like they can't eat. They lose their appetite, and so they lose weight. So I'm looking for either unexpected weight gain or weight loss. Definitely impacts your mood. If you don't have enough serotonin in your life, it's hard to enjoy life. It's hard to feel happiness. It impairs your ability. Like, you can see happiness through the foggy window, but you can't really enjoy it fully. There's a really big one here that a lot of people are unaware of, is that it inhibits pain. And so this is why in people with chronic pain conditions, for instance, chronic migraines or fibromyalgia, or just simply chronic pain from some sort of an injury that has lasting impact, one of the methods of therapy is to manage their serotonin levels. So these people may say, but I don't feel depressed. I'm fine. But the serotonin regulation over time, especially with chronic pain that just drains that system, you're just pushing on it. You need a little boost on that. And so it's not uncommon to be prescribed an antidepressant to help boost your serotonin availability, to help your body not feel so much pain. Dopamine, like I already mentioned, this one's essential to movement. This is why when someone has low dopamine, their depression manifestation may be that they just feel like a slug. Like, it is so hard for them to get out of bed in the morning and to get moving. It also influences motivation. So, like, I know I need to go to work. I just cannot make myself go to work. I want to be a good mom. I want to get up and play with my kids. I don't know why I don't feel like I can, but I just don't have any motivation to do that. And then they feel guilt because they don't have the motivation to take care of those kinds of things. The reward system, this is a really important component of addiction medicine. Those little bursts of dopamine make you feel so good. Like when you, say, go skiing down a hill at 90 miles an hour and you get that blast of endorphins, that's your dopamine giving you the woohoo feeling, okay? So our brains love that. That's why people tend to seek bigger and bigger thrills to get more and more of that dopamine. The other things that do that for us, cigarettes, okay? Cigarettes are the most addictive of all the drugs, worse than heroin, meth, all those other ones, because it gives you this blast of dopamine with every push of the cigarette. And you cannot duplicate that with other things. So nicotine gum or a nicotine patch gives you a steady release of dopamine, but you don't get that spike like you do with cigarettes. It is so hard once you've trained your brain that it needs to be constantly bathed in dopamine to back off on that. I have all the respect for the people that have been able to kick that addiction. That's a really tough one. The other one that I want to point out here is dopamine influences your perception of reality. A few examples of that. One of the things in a spiritual context is that this can influence your ability to feel that you could be loved by God, that you could feel the Spirit, that you could feel worthy to partake in the religious ordinances or to even pray or to feel like you can communicate with God. So dopamine deficiency is something that Satan can use to his advantage to drive a wedge between you and your relationship with God. And that's something that a lot of people, like, that's a relief for them to hear because they have felt unworthy and then stopped doing those things that help draw them closer to God. And really, if we can work on their brain chemistry and help them realize, this is something we can totally fix, and this is not you. You are not unworthy. You're not a bad person. Your Heavenly Father loves you. Then that can help with that healing process. The other thing I see with this, I had a gentleman in clinic last week, and I asked him, about his feelings of guilt and worthlessness. That's how the alterations in perception of reality often manifests. And he said, I just think I'm a failure. I think I haven't accomplished as much with my life as I maybe should, or that other people around me have. And I said, you know what, I think that's the low dopamine talking, because I know your wife, and I know that if I asked her, what do you think of your husband? She'd say, he's a good dad. He's a good dad to our kids. He's a good husband. He's a hard worker. He works hard, even though it's really hard for him to work through his depression, his ADHD. And if you asked your coworkers, they'd say, this guy's been working for us for 20 years. He's super reliable. He knows his job. He's good stuff. But his self-perception is, I'm a failure. I'm no good. Okay? So think about how that influences your behavior if you have low dopamine. Norepinephrine. Norepinephrine has a lot of other systemic effects. This is one of those stress hormones, too. When you're under a lot of stress and you have constant cortisol dumping into your system, your body's like, I don't know, this looks like a bad thing going on. I think we better store a lot of fat, because that's really useful, right? That, I don't know, cushions you against the blows of life. I don't know how that works. Cortisol, constant cortisol is not good for you. Constant norepinephrine isn't either. Norepinephrine stimulates your cardiac muscle to beat faster. It raises your blood pressure. It causes constriction of the blood vessels to non-essential organs, including your guts. And so it's part of why you might get a stomach ache and things out of whack when you're feeling anxious. Also, there's more serotonin receptors in your gut than there are in your brain. So your gut's very sensitive to stressors that affect either your serotonin or your norepinephrine, okay? Norepinephrine triggers that fight or flight. So between cortisol and norepinephrine, you have fat storage and the person that's ready to jump out of the cage, fight or flight, okay? So you can see how over time, that's very, very stressful for your body to be constantly keyed up with these hormones in excess. Some other neurotransmitters, we talked about acetylcholine already, how it's the opposite of dopamine, essentially. It also is really important in memory and recall. Glutamate, we know, is an excitatory one. So if it's excessive and unopposed, then that's where you get the mania in bipolar disorder. Okay? They're like, whew, high as a kite, you know, jumping off of tall buildings with a single bound, spending themselves into bankruptcy. It's a very difficult disorder to deal with. And then we have GABA. And this is one that I kind of jokingly say when I give this presentation to Mormon congregations, but not jokingly, this is one of the major reasons why there's so much depression in Utah, because the way people outside of Utah or outside of Mormonism deal with their stressors is to drink a little bit of wine, and that hits those GABA receptors and calms you right down, right? We don't have that advantage in Mormonism. So instead, we have a whole bunch of really depressed, anxious people trying to be perfect, and that's not a good combination. So these neurotransmitters work in a variety of places in your brain. A few things I like to point out on this. We have what I call kind of the lizard brain down there in the center. That's the amygdala, the hippocampus, and the thalamus. And those are responsible for responding to input and deciding whether to fling out some norepinephrine. Like, do we need to have this fight or flight response? Processing what's coming in through the cortex and deciding if it's a threat or not. The hippocampus, they've actually done imaging studies in chronically depressed people and found that it actually shrinks. So you have literal structural changes in the brain with people with chronic depression that's not treated. So when people say it's all in your head, you can say, heck yes, it's all in my head. It totally is in my head. But it's real, it's legitimate, it's a chemistry problem, and it's a structural problem. The prefrontal cortex there, I like to point that out. I always tell my kids all the time, sorry kids, you've got like another decade before your prefrontal cortex is fully developed. You're going to continue to make stupid decisions and do impulsive things, and it's your brain's fault. And it'll grow out of it. But that does not mature fully until around age 25. And so that's where a lot of this impulsive behavior and inability to see the long-term consequences of decisions kind of stuff comes in. What causes depression? I've already given you a few little teasers. One of the things we know is that trauma at an early age can literally change the structure of how your brain responds to future threats. This patient I saw today that had been sexually abused as a child, we talked about that a lot. And she talked about some other things that have come along in her life, like how she's had difficulty being around men. even men who were non-threatening, nice, kind, gentle men who were, you know, in no way going to harm her, but the amygdala in her brain is now hardwired to feel like a threat is coming at her. So that's something she's working through with a specialized type of therapy, but it's really, really rough. It's changed how her brain responds to threats. We know there's a survey called the ACE survey, Adverse Childhood Events, and the more of those things, and this includes, you know, witnessing violence, divorce of parents, any sort of physical, mental, or sexual abuse, a whole bunch of different things along those lines, being deprived of food, all those things additively put you at tremendous risk, not just for mental disability, but for early death from a variety of causes. We know that chronic stress impacts your cardiovascular health and all the whole rest of your body. And so it's a real legitimate thing, and we should never discount that. Genetics, oh my goodness, mood disorders tend to run in families. Just like high cholesterol runs in some families and autoimmune disorders run in some families, this is one of those things where everyone has their little storage rack of serotonin, norepinephrine, dopamine, right? Some people have really big jugs. They've got like the 10-year supply. So when they have a stressful thing come along, they're like, psh, whatever, I've got tons more. I'm good. Other people come into life with a genetically predisposed little teeny tiny milk cartons worth of each of those. And as they encounter stressful event after stressful event, they kind of wear down that extra food storage until they get to a point where it's more than what their body can cope with and keep replenishing. And that's where some intervention is needed. So some people just drew the lucky stick and have the gallons and gallons of reserve, but most of us don't have that. Just so you know, that's okay. Life circumstances, for sure. I've seen a lot of patients who are like, I'm usually fine, but I'm in the middle of this horrific divorce and I just can't stop crying and the stress is overwhelming and I don't know what to do. And so that can trigger situational anxiety or depression. And the nice thing about that is a lot of times once that situation resolves, then so does the mood disorder. So it's not so much of a permanent thing. Brain structure. Definitely, if you've had any structural changes, my son has had now 3 concussions. He got another one last week. Naughty little boy, snowboarding. 2 out of 3 were snowboarding. The other one was skateboarding. So I think we need to rethink his life choices about his hobbies. Anyway, yeah, that prefrontal cortex is not developed. At least he was wearing his helmet the second 2 times, and we recognized it much more quickly. I actually did my doctoral project on concussion because of our experience with him. His first concussion, we didn't recognize it right away, and it triggered 2 years of almost daily migraines and a mood disorder. And so this changed the structure of his brain. Thankfully, he eventually healed, but it took a lot of concerted effort and a lot of intervention to get him over that. And so anything that damages the structure of the brain, disrupts the flow of those neurotransmitters, definitely can trigger a mood disorder. And medical conditions. This is one of those things. Is it a chicken or an egg? What came first? Do you have sleep problems because you have depression, or do you have depression because of your sleep problems? And so this is where my role as a clinician is to always dig deep and see if there's something biological I can root out that may be contributing or causing this that we can fix first. So that could include low testosterone for guys. Sleep apnea, huge. Oh my goodness, that's really huge. Thyroid problems, vitamin D deficiency, also enormous. I can't even tell you how many patients come in with significant deficiencies. And in our clinic, we feel like the appropriate range for that is much higher than what the lab range. The lab range will say 30 to 80 or 30 to 100, depending on the lab. And we find that most people do best above 60. And so my good friend that came to see me last week, her vitamin D was 12. I'm like, no wonder you're depressed. We had a young teenager, 13 years old, that came in suicidal, and her thyroid, her TSH normal range is 0.5 to 4.5. Hers was 132, so her thyroid was not working, and her vitamin D was in the single digits. So those are biological things that we can fix that can help the mood tremendously. So we always look for those. Also, when people have chronic conditions, anything that's chronic that's not going to go away anytime soon puts a lot of strain on your body's ability to rebound from that constant stress hormone dump, the cortisol, the norepinephrine. And so it's very, very common to have comorbid depression with a chronic illness. Definitely substance abuse can predispose you to depression. Like we talked about with dopamine, if you have something that's hijacking that dopamine reward system, then you have to keep taking more and more and more of it as your body upregulates the number of receptors to receive that. Like, oh, you're going to bathe us in dopamine? Let's make more pots for it, because boy, howdy, I sure love dopamine. So then if those people ever try to stop or pull back, then you can see how that triggers a significant imbalance in their brain chemistry and makes them feel really, really bad. All of these things can lead to changes in your brain that cause actual physical symptoms. I have this picture of these two dogs here. I love this picture. We have the little puppy with mud up to his chin, and next to him, the long-legged dog that's just grinning and happy as can be with only muddy ankles. They went through the same circumstance, the same mud puddle. One came out of it feeling like it was the worst day of his life and he almost drowned. And the other one's like, psh, whatever, no big deal. I call this the long legs principle, and it's a principle of resiliency. There are times in our lives when we have long legs, so to speak, where we sail through something, a difficult test, a hard semester, a bump in our marriage, a crisis with our kids, and we feel like, I've got this. I'm strong. I've got a good support system. I feel good. I've got good coping mechanisms. And you move on and you're good. But there's other times when you've been beaten down by mud puddle after mud puddle after mud puddle, and your legs get shorter and shorter and shorter. And the same thing that you sailed through last year feels like an insurmountable challenge this time. I just think of my own, I like to relate this to like personal experiences here, like the first marathon I ran where I felt like I was going to die the whole time because I didn't know what to expect, and I barely made it to the finish line and may have thrown up. It wasn't my finest hour. But then once you've been through it once, you're like, I've got longer legs. I know what to expect. So there's something to be said for life experience giving you the perspective, knowing that you can actually make it across that mud puddle in one piece. So how do you know if you're depressed? This is a golden question. I asked some youth, one of the times when I was teaching this, I asked them, what do you think of when you think of someone who's depressed? They're like, crying? You know, that was the best they could come up with. All they could think of was just the mood part of it. Maybe if someone's really sad. The main thing with this is that everyone has bad days. You're going to go through life and you're going to have ups and downs. And all of us in this room have a really good history of making it through bad days. We all have 100% track record of making it through bad days. So congratulations. You've made it through all the bad days you've been thrown so far. Depression as a diagnosis is characterized by a persistence of symptoms. This is not a couple of bad days that got you down, but you were able to snap out of it with some exercise, some self-care, some meditation, those kinds of things. This is two or more weeks of symptoms that are present more days than not. So I had a patient in clinic today that was like, you know, I called yesterday to make this appointment because I was feeling really bad in the morning, but then by the evening I was feeling better and I thought, maybe I'm stupid for making this appointment. And her husband's over in the corner like, please do something. This has not been good. She's like, yeah, I've had maybe four good days in the last month, and those days make me feel like I'm okay. But more days than not, she's very, very down and having difficulty functioning. So the characteristic here is this persistence, that more days than not, it's really interfering with your life. You also have trouble rebounding from something that normally wouldn't have fazed you that much. So something bad happens at work and normally you'd shrug that off, and this time you're just upset and agitated and you can't get over it and you just can't pull back from it. So those are all signs that your brain is depleted on that little neurotransmitted storage, and we need to help it along. And then always, like I said before, we need to rule out any other health problems that can either mimic or contribute to depression. You're in good company. Millions of Americans have depression every year. Like I said before, Utah has a higher incidence of suicide and of depression than surrounding states. There's a lot of theories behind this. One of the things we know is that living at higher altitude is correlated with higher rates of depression. We don't know exactly why. I also have spoken with some people who believe that our air quality impacts that. Yay, today's a yellow day. Super. We've had a few red days, not too many. Not only just because it's gloomy and kind of yucky outside, but that it actually causes chemical changes in our body that we react to, that causes stress in our body, whether we realize it or not, it's causing stress in our body. Also, there's significant social pressure here in this state, as I'm sure you guys are well aware of, that's I don't know that it's unique to our state, like other places have different kinds of cultural pressure, but certainly here, especially within the LDS Mormon community, there's so much pressure to be perfect, to fit in, to conform to these standards and perfect ideals and those kinds of things. And in Utah, like I mentioned before, those of us that are in the Mormon population tend not to drink our sorrows away. So we tend to report that and be treated more for depression. I also teach a youth suicide prevention curriculum. There's some other factors in there for why we think suicide is more prevalent, but that's a whole nother topic. So we'll move on with this one. When I'm in clinic, you can't probably see this cartoon very well, but it's depression parkour. The guy's sitting in his bed and he's like, one, two, three, go. And he's flopping over, finally makes it out of bed, flops onto the floor and it says, you did it. Good job. Okay. That's what low dopamine looks like right there, is the person that needs a forklift or a spatula to get him out of bed. One of the two. When I'm talking to people in clinic, I go through these categories that are listed on this slide. I talk to them about their sleep. Like I said before, do you have a hard time going to sleep, staying asleep? Do you find that you wake up early in the morning? Do you find that you wake up feeling unrefreshed? Do you find that you sleep for 14 hours and still need to take a nap later in the day because you're so wiped out? All of those are indicators of some serotonin deficiency. Have you lost interest in things that you normally would like to do? So to ascertain this information, I'll ask people, so what kinds of things do you like to do for fun? And if I get a response that's like, well, I used to like to go rock climbing, but I don't know why I haven't done that. I just haven't really felt like it anymore. I'll ask them, if you had the option to do something with your family, like go out to a movie, would that feel overwhelming to you? Or would it feel like something that you just couldn't even muster up the energy to do? And that's another one of those indicators for me. We talk about guilt a lot, and this goes back to that dopamine deficiency. Do you feel those sense of worthlessness, the guilt that you're not doing good enough, whatever good enough means? Those all go along with that alteration in perception of reality that goes with the dopamine deficiency. Energy is a huge one. People come to the clinic with a complaint of fatigue, and after we've ruled out all those other biologic causes, we come back around to mood disorders. So if you come in with fatigue and I have tested everything and we've talked through a lot of things and I can see some other factors there, then that's a strong indicator. Concentration. Here's a little tidbit for you to tuck in your brain. Some people will come to me and say, I think I developed ADHD. And I say, oh yeah, when did this start? And they'll say, about 6 months ago. Well, one of the criteria for diagnosis of ADHD is that you have to have had those symptoms present during childhood. You don't have sudden adult onset ADHD, okay? But when you have these neurotransmitter deficiencies, it interferes with your brain's ability to process and store information and to concentrate. So that makes you feel like you have ADHD. Obviously, I need to rule out other things that can interfere with cognitive performance, but this is one of the other big indicators. It's a red flag to me. Changes in appetite, either eating your feelings or not eating because you have feelings. Either of those are a warning sign. We have changes in movement, kind of like this cartoon depicts with the depression parkour. I've had some people come into my office and they're just like slugs, like they're just shuffling down the hall and they sit down and they sit and they have their eyes downcast and you talk to them and it takes them, they kind of have a delay as they look up and they answer slowly. It literally changes their ability to move at a normal pace. The other thing we sometimes see is what we call psychomotor agitation, where people are so anxious and so worked up or even depressed that that comes out in inability to sit still or to settle. Both of those are concerning. The biggest one that I save for last is suicidal ideation. The most common thing that I hear from people is that they have this kind of passive feeling of, I just can't deal with this anymore, and it wouldn't be all bad if I just didn't wake up tomorrow. So it's not active thoughts of killing themselves, but it's really, really, really common had three patients in office today that told me, yeah, I've had those thoughts of it wouldn't be bad if my car just ran off a cliff, but then I wouldn't want to hurt anyone else, so I don't necessarily want my car to run off the cliff. Maybe if I just didn't wake up, that would be okay. That's concerning to me, but what's more concerning is if someone tells me, yeah, I've thought about killing myself, and then I say, do you have a plan for that? And if they say, yeah, I have a gun at my house, and I would use that, or I would take pills. Any of those things are definite reasons for concern and escalation for my action. I don't know if you guys can read this slide very well. Can you see it all? Okay, you guys have better eyes than I do. Good for you. Be glad. So symptoms of depression come in four major categories. We have our emotions, which can include sadness, anxiety, hopelessness or helplessness, guilt, anger, mood swings, and irritability. And mood swings, the irritability component is really common in males, also can see it in females. That was a couple of my patients that I saw today, where they're like, I'm just ripping my kid's head off. Every time my husband tries to do something nice for me, then I'm like, rah! And then I don't know why I do that. I hate that I do that. I just feel like I don't have control over my emotions. So this real liability of the emotions. Physical, you may have some unexplained aches and pains, sleep problems, loss of motivation, weight changes, chronic fatigue, or low energy. With thoughts, we already talked a bit about the feelings of guilt, but this is this concept of self-criticism, problems with concentration, indecisiveness. When they tell me, going to the grocery store right now is crippling for me because I have to decide all the things. She says, if I stay at home and I plan out the list exactly before I go and I feel like I have everything on the list before I go, then it's okay. But if I go there and it's just like, I'll go there and see what I want to make for dinner, then that's just crippling. It causes too much frustration. I just have to go home. Okay? She says, I didn't used to be like this. I don't know what's wrong with me. I know what's wrong with you. We can fix that. Thoughts of death and suicide. Behavior. There's a lot of cues here. Some people cry. Not everyone. You don't have to be crying to be depressed. Anytime you see someone withdrawing from their people or their duties, and this is something I try and teach my teenagers, this is especially problematic in teens, is that if you see them withdrawing from their usual things, they're kind of disappearing into their own little world, their closet, hanging out in their room with their headphones on and not going out with their friends like they used to. Those are all real big warning signs. And we talked a bit more about the moving more slowly, being agitated or unable to settle, and then changes in appearance. This is one of the things I note and I chart on is people's hygiene and their appearance. Because when you're really depressed, you stop caring. So if you show up at my clinic and it's clear that you haven't showered in a very long time and your oral hygiene's really bad and you're wearing rumpled, stinky clothes, those are all warning signs to me. And then often as people start to feel better, that's reflected in their appearance. So let's talk about some of these physical symptoms that can come along with depression. Anytime someone has kind of chronic, unexplained pain. So we've ruled out an acute injury, or they say, gosh, I just don't really know what happened, but my back just started hurting, and they don't recall a specific injury. That to me is kind of like a ding, ding, ding. Like, this could be something that's a manifestation of a brain chemistry imbalance, especially if we do an exam and we do x-rays. Maybe I'll send you to physical therapy, and we're not getting resolution of that. Frequent headaches. And again, that's a chicken or an egg kind of thing. Did the frequent headaches trigger the depression because you feel so darn crappy, or the other way around? But in any case, that can be one of the manifestations, especially in kids. If they have frequent tummy aches and frequent headaches, that should be a red flag for you. They have a hard time verbalizing what's going on in their emotions. They don't necessarily have the words or the vocabulary or the ability to put those things together in their head. And so that's definitely a warning sign. Chest pain. My gosh, 95% of the people that come to the emergency room that are under the age of 40 with chest pain, in the absence of trauma, assuming you didn't take a steering wheel to your chest or something, it's anxiety. Okay, almost never cardiac. I don't want to say never, because sometimes it's cardiac. Most of the time it's not. So digestive disturbances are huge. Irritable bowel syndrome, when there's no structural things wrong with your colon. It's not ulcerative colitis, it's not Crohn's disease, it's not celiac, but you just have this chronic, like, constipation, then diarrhea, and cramps, and pain, and all those things. Those are physiologic, functional disturbances as a result of your brain chemistry imbalances. So there's a couple ways you can treat that. You can throw medications at the symptom, or you can work on balancing the gut, realizing the gut and the mind work together, and work on the brain chemistry upstairs, and a lot of times the lower stuff resolves. Definitely when people have exhaustion or fatigue or sleep problems or changes in weight that aren't explained other ways, then I consider depression or anxiety in that. So let's talk about some special populations. We have our children and teens. Like I mentioned before, kids are more likely to manifest with chronic stomach aches or headaches because that's the physical manifestation of those alterations in their brain chemistry. And so this is your job as a grown-up person to help them learn how to label that and to figure out what the root cause of it is and see if you can help explore that with them and take care of that. When your tummy feels like this, it's trying to tell you something about this. What happened when you started feeling like your tummy was hurting? You know, those kinds of things. Have those kind of dialogues. One of the things that's really worrisome about kids, though, is that they're impulsive because that prefrontal cortex is not fully developed. Okay? In Utah, our youth suicide rate, the national average is climbing steadily, but our youth suicide rate is climbing even faster than the national average. We are well above the national average, like double the national average on our youth suicide rate. And that's because kids are impulsive. When they decide to do something, they don't often understand the permanence of it. I'm trained in this youth suicide prevention curriculum, and the person who taught me is Greg Hudnall. He's founded the Hope for Utah. They do the Hope Squads in the high schools, all that kind of stuff. And he told me that he went and visited with one kid who was in the hospital after a failed suicide attempt. Unsuccessful. I don't know, that sounds like the wrong thing to say. When you're saying unsuccessful, we're glad it was not successful. A suicide attempt that didn't go all the way through. And he talked to this young man and said, what was going through your head when you pulled this trigger? And he said, well, I was so upset that my girlfriend broke up with me that I thought I would show her. I'd kill myself today and then we'd be back together on Monday. Okay, so literally, the frontal cortex is not fully developed. They don't see the long-term implications of this, and they have a hard time seeing past a bad day. So this is something, as grown-ups, that you can help them see what it feels like to fail, give them bumpers and support to allow them to fail, and then to help them pick themselves back up. Because that's one of the most important lessons they can learn, is how to fail gracefully, pick yourself back up, dust yourself off, and realize that today was a bad day, and there's always tomorrow, and I'm going to be okay. Yeah?
I don't get how that explains why youth suicide in Utah is so much higher, because that's it. No child of that age has that issue,
yeah.
Has that connection.
So in Utah, we don't have good answers why it's higher. We know that overall, depression is higher in Utah than in surrounding states because of the altitude, because of the social pressures, all those factors. There's a lot of different reasons. So Utah's suicide rate is increasing, and we don't know why, and that's problematic. One of the things in that QPR, the youth suicide presentation that I do, is we go over the SHARP survey data. It's a statewide survey that the Department of Health does in 8th, 10th, and 12th grades, and they take random samplings from all the different schools in the entire state and then aggregate that data. And it's on a variety of risky behaviors, including, like, have you been exposed to alcohol in the last 30 days? If you were offered alcohol, did you actually drink it? Those kinds of things. So it covers a whole lot of ground. But one of the things it covers is emotional health. And what's interesting in my slides for that presentation is you see a very sharp uptick around 2010 in the incidence of feelings of hopelessness and despair, and that lasted longer than 2 weeks, and all these problematic behaviors that lead to suicide attempts. And that correlates with when smartphones became really ubiquitous. When kids transitioned from having the little flip phones or the slider outer phones with the little keypads, now to smartphones that have access to all that the internet has to offer and Snapchat and all the things that put so much social pressure on them. And so that's one of the major factors. And this has been a nationwide trend. There have been a lot of papers published on this, that with the increased use of smartphones, that correlates, maybe doesn't cause, if you guys understand science, causation, correlation, two different things, but strongly correlates with the uptick in the presentation of anxiety in school and college settings and suicide, all those kinds of things. So that's one of the factors. What can we do about that? I don't know. That's a really good question. It is a national factor. So when Utah is already ahead of the curve, that just poured gas on the fire. So I think the takeaway lesson from that is to be really mindful of how we teach teens to use the media and have screen access. It's good for them to have it tucked away, not in their bedroom at night. Teaching them how to navigate social media wisely, and that's really difficult. Heck, a lot of adults need help with that, right? Not looking at the perfectly varnished veneer of other people's lives and feeling like you need to keep up with that. Seniors, okay, so back to children. Sorry, I got sidetracked here. The other things you're looking for in teens is if their performance in school suddenly slides down, that's a big indicator that things are going on that are impairing their concentration, their ability to function in that way. And if you see them withdrawing from their friends or engaging in risky behavior, those are all warning signs. The other special population up here is seniors. And even though I teach youth suicide prevention, we teach it as youth suicide prevention because that's the only way you get people to come. They're not excited about coming to old people suicide prevention, right? But the reality is that when you look at the curve of the age groups on the suicide, youth is way down here. It's small. We focus on it because it's the leading cause of death in youth, but that's because they don't have diabetes, cancer, heart disease, all those other things killing them. And this is a preventable cause of death. But it increases with age to the point that older males in particular are like 10 times the suicide rate of youth. Older people are at very high risk for death by suicide. They also often, you'll see some cognitive decline in them, and that may be a sign of depression and not necessarily dementia. So that warrants a closer look. So again, watch for these signs and someone's not taking care of themselves. They're not taking care of their health conditions. They're not checking their blood sugar like they should be. They're not taking their medication. They're not taking care of their personal hygiene. All those are kind of warning signs for you. Let's talk about anxiety. I like this little cartoon. It says, anxiety girl is able to leap to the worst conclusions in a single bound. That's kind of anxiety in a nutshell. Okay, I had a patient in clinic that's super anxious. And then she was on medication and doing well. And then she got anxious that she might not have access to her medication in case of, I don't know, zombie apocalypse or some natural disaster. So she tried weaning herself off. Well, that was a really bad idea because that just ramped up the anxiety even more. But she came to me and was like, can you prescribe twice as many for me as I'm really going to take so that I can just have some and reserve? I'm not going to feed into this. Nope. Come back and see me. But she's like leaping to the worst conclusion in a single bound. My house is going to collapse. I won't have access to my Celexa, and then we're all toast. So I've got to learn how to live without that. People who tend to live with anxiety for a long time, not realizing that you shouldn't always feel this sense of impending doom, okay, or apprehension, or worry, constant worry, inability to enjoy life because you're so worried about something bad happening to your kids, or your inability to measure up to whatever standards there are. Reviewing conversations that you've had with people over and over and over when the person that you talked to, like, literally didn't remember what you said 2 seconds later, but you go home and it's spinning around in your head and you worry and worry and worry and worry and worry and worry and perseverate over that and think you're the worst person in the world because you said something stupid and I'm sure they noticed that I smiled kind of weird and my eye was twitchy. That person doesn't remember, but this is causing a lot of internal turmoil for the person who suffers from anxiety. They tend to have difficulty concentrating. They anticipate the worst. They can be restless, irritable. There's a lot of physical symptoms that come along with this because that's norepinephrine dumping in like crazy. So it can cause, when you're having a panic attack, pounding heart, chest pain, the sense of chest pressure, the sense of impending doom, a lot of digestive disturbances. There's really a lot of the sweating and tremors, all those things go with it. Another interesting one is frequent urination. And I see this a lot in anxious little kids. Tummy aches and peeing all the time. So the parents keep bringing them in. I think they have a UTI. Nope, not a UTI. It's anxiety. Sorry about that. It's not nearly as awesome. If you haven't, this next cartoon sums up anxiety quite nicely. If you've never heard of Awkward Yeti, I highly recommend that you follow them. They're just very amusing and very clean. And I just love anatomy and medical humor because I'm a nerd. But these ones just speak to me. So heart and brain are always having conversations with each other. Heart is like off chasing daisies and butterflies, and brain is always being the logical one. So here we have heart saying to brain, hey, brain, pain. Is there anything we can do to help you with your anxiety? And brain says, I don't know. And stomach says, what if I contort myself like this? And brain says, I don't know. And then colon over there says, and I'll just move things along really fast or really slow, depending on your preference. And he says, I don't know. And then the heart says, and I'll pump as fast as my little me can pump. And brain says, how does that even? And then the eyes say, hey, what if one of us twitches periodically? And then they're all out there twitching and pumping and all those things. And brain says, you all look ridiculous. And they say, does that mean it's working? That's how being an anxious person feels. Your body's rebelling against you. It's twitching, it's pounding, it's, you know, contorting the intestines, all unbidden. You don't want that to happen, but you have a hard time making it stop. Those same neurotransmitters that are responsible for depression are also the ones that are involved in anxiety. So it's different levels of ups and downs of the two. So a lot of the same medications work for both. That's the good news, because a lot of times people have some of both. And so it's just a matter of figuring out what's your more prominent thing. Is the anxiety worse or is the depression worse? But they tend to be bedfellows. There are a number of different forms of anxiety. For some people, it's just purely social anxiety. So standing up here speaking to you right now and being recorded would be like deathly for someone who has performance anxiety. For other people, it's fear. You know, there's all the different fears of open space, fear of closed spaces. All those are different forms of anxiety. Generalized anxiety is when someone just feels nervous and worried and keyed up all the time and can't ever turn it off. Panic disorder is when you have those acute spikes where you have the panic attack where you feel like you're literally going to die. And the first time I ever encountered someone having a panic attack was when I was a newly minted EMT working on BYU campus and came across this guy that, like, you could tell that he was in a really, really bad state. And I was like, my gosh, EMT school did not teach me anything about what's going on with this guy. And he was having a panic attack. He couldn't make any sense. He couldn't talk to us. You couldn't talk him out of his zone of claustrophobia, you know, whatever was going on in his head. And so I'll never forget what that looked like, because it's a very, very real experience for those people. So you can say it's just a panic attack, but it is a real physiologic, terrifying process for the people that are experiencing it. The other thing that we need to be mindful of is that a lot of times anxiety, the inability to concentrate, can look like ADHD. So sometimes people are not treated appropriately for one or the other. This little cartoon says, I wasted all day today worrying about the yesterday that nobody will remember tomorrow. Once again, that sums up anxiety very nicely. So when do you need to get help? Absolutely, if you feel like hurting yourself. I see a lot of teens that cut or do other forms of self-harm, and it can look like burning or rubbing their skin. There's a whole bunch of different ways they think of to hurt themselves. Definitely need to get help in that circumstance. But even if you're not actively thinking of it, but if you're having those passive thoughts of, it wouldn't be so bad if I just didn't wake up tomorrow, that's a good reason to get help. Anytime your depression or anxiety is interfering with your ability to function in your work life, home life, your relationships, or with your ability to enjoy life. It tells us in the scriptures, men are that they might have joy. We're meant to experience joy here on earth. It's not meant to feel like drudgery. I liken these neurotransmitter problems with dragging sandbags. Yes, you can keep going forward while you're dragging those sandbags. We're all really strong people. By dang, we can show you, we can drag this 50 pounds behind us. But are we supposed to have to feel like that through life? No, we're not supposed to have to feel like that. So let's take care of ourselves and heal ourselves and get feeling better. My husband picked out this cartoon specifically for the treatment one. My husband and I both come by depression genes, quite honestly. After our baby girl died a few years ago, that was a significant trigger for both of us and took both of us a decade to decide that it was okay to seek some treatment for that, because, you know, we're strong enough and good enough and gosh dang it, we can drag those sandbags. And for him, it was an absolute revelation starting treatment with Wellbutrin, which targets dopamine. And so now he kind of jokingly, but not jokingly, says, everyone should have that sprinkled in their breakfast cereal. We can all use a little bit of dopamine, you know? So this cartoon says, each 8-ounce serving contains the minimum daily requirement of vitamins, minerals, and antidepressants. So, you know, start your day out right. Successful treatment, just like any other disease process, is not just one thing. It's not a magic pill. If I told a diabetic, hey, here's a vial of insulin, good luck, then I would be giving really bad care to a diabetic. They need diet counseling. They need to learn how to count carbs. They need to learn how to check their glucose. They need to have dosing instructions on their insulin and how to deal with sick days when they're sicker than usual and have different insulin requirements. They need to learn that they have to have their A1C checked regularly, their microalbumin and creatinine. They need to have their feet checked, their eyes checked. The list goes on. So just like any of those other disorders, there's a lot of self-care that goes on, and the medicine is a small portion of it. This is the same. So with depression, successful treatment can include counseling, medication, lots of self-care, management of any other underlying chronic diseases that are going along with that, support from your family and friends, spiritual support, and time. We all have this history of getting through rough patches. A lot of times these things pass with some time and patience, but that doesn't mean that you shouldn't actively be doing something about it while you're in the middle of it. That takes me to my next slide here that's my pit principle, that sometimes life hands you a little divot in the road, a bad day, a bad 2 days, something that a good long walk with a good friend and a little carton of Ben & Jerry's Caramel Sutra ice cream eaten with a spoon directly out of the carton will help you perk up and get over that bad day. Other times, life creates a big sinkhole, a big pit for you, and it takes a whole lot of things layered on top of each other to bring you up out of that pit to where you can see daylight again and see your way out of it. So it just depends on your life circumstances and what's been handed you. I'm a big fan of counseling. That being said, I fully recognize how difficult it is to make that leap and actually schedule an appointment and go. I did not personally do grief counseling for the loss of my daughter until a year ago. Okay? No, because I'm good enough. Gosh darn it, I can drag these sandbags. I'm fine. I'm a medical professional. I can talk my own way through it. And then I realized when I was up at the University of Utah on my 7th out of 8th semesters, oh, hey, they have this counseling center here. It's a resource for students. You know, it takes me a while. I'm not always the sharpest on these kinds of things. It was useful even 11 years after the fact, after the death of my daughter, to go through that grief processing. It's hard work. Each time when I went to the counseling place, they would have me fill out a little survey, a series of questions. And I never saw the scoring or anything like that. And on about my 5th visit, the counselor said, I can tell you're feeling better today, when I walked down the office to her room. I said, oh, yeah? How's that? And so she popped up her computer screen and showed me, here's your score from your first visit. You can see how it jumped for the next 3 visits, and then you're finally on the downhill slide. And it's because when you go through counseling, you have to dig up the old, cruddy, hard, hurty stuff, and you have to work your way through it. And it's not pleasant, but it's worth it. Okay? It's hard work. There's a number of different styles of counseling. One of the things I like to encourage people is that if the first person, or even the second or third person that you meet with, doesn't feel like a good fit for you, move on. Don't give up. Don't feel like, well, I went to counseling once, and that was a really bad experience. When my son was in the middle of his concussion-induced mood disorders and migraines, one of the finally successful treatment modalities we did for him was to do some counseling. And the first guy I took him to, I called up the counseling center and said, hey, I want to get him in with this guy. I looked at his profile, and I think he'd be a good fit for my son. Like, he's like several weeks out, blah, blah, blah. We've got this other guy. And I said, well, this is my 14-year-old son. Do you think he's good with kids? And the lady's like, I don't know. He's new. He's probably fine. He seems nice. Oh, this guy was nuts. He talked to us about dinosaurs and Vietnam War for the hour we were in there. And I was like, I kept saying, like, okay, so we're here to discuss my son's chronic. Oh, no, he'll be fine. He's a kid. Kids are young. They get over things. I was like, oh, my gosh, this is the worst. Thankfully, my son trusted me enough to allow me to take him back to another person, and he had a much better experience with the second person. And I did 8 or 10 sessions, and that was the turning point for him in getting over this chronic pain cycle that he was in. So I really believe in counseling. One of the modes of therapy that I find myself referring people for really frequently is called EMDR. It's an eye movement desensitization form of therapy that's extraordinarily successful for people that have significant trauma, so PTSD, big events that really triggered their depression or their anxiety, and it's remarkable to see the results of that. Therapy counseling of some form is really good because it can track your progress in your recovery, and they can see signs when you're getting worse. I do have some patients that come to me after their counselor says, hey, I've been seeing you for like 3 months and I feel like we're stuck. I think you could consider medication at this point. Then they refer them back to me. And so you can have this good collaborative relationship between the counselor and the healthcare provider to provide the best total care for this patient. Medication can be very beneficial. I wish there are some herbal supplements that I do recommend in certain circumstances that can be used cautiously. One of the problems with herbs in general and supplements is that they're regulated as a food and not as a drug. And so the manufacturing is really variable. You can't guarantee that what's in there is what says on the label is actually what's in it. And so there are some issues with that. You're kind of taking some risks with that. Also, a lot of people feel like they're very innocuous. Like, oh, I'm taking all these herbs. I'm sure they're fine. They're natural. They have a lot of interactions. Like St. John's wort, for instance, is one that people commonly use for depression, but it has tons and tons of interactions with other medications. So what I would say to that is, please, if you're ever taking any herbs or supplements or vitamins, please tell your healthcare provider so that they can make sure there's not going to be a bad interaction between those. I have some patients who are very leery about starting a prescription medication for this, so there are some herbs and supplements that I'll recommend to them as a trial, and if those work for them, then great. If not, then we can move on to prescription medication. These are targeted at increasing the availability of these neurotransmitters. So we have the class called SSRIs. That includes Prozac, Zoloft, Celexa, Lexapro. You've probably heard of these. And what those do, back to our brain biology at the beginning, when your body uses those chemical messengers to jump across that synapse, then it recycles and reuses those neurotransmitters. When there's not enough, then it sucks it up too quickly and recycles it too quickly and doesn't allow it to linger in the synapse the way it's supposed to. And so these medications slow that reuptake process to allow more of it to linger in that space to carry those messages back and forth. There's other ones that target dopamine like Wellbutrin. There's ones that target norepinephrine like Effexor or Cymbalta. So there's nuances, there's pluses and minuses to all of these, but they can be very, very beneficial for people. One of the things is that a lot of times it takes a few dose changes or maybe even trying two or three different medications to find the right fit, since they all have different side effect profiles. And so it takes some patience and some follow through. I like this cartoon. It says, in the 1930s, the entire country was suffering from a Great Depression. Fortunately, they have pills for that now. Perfect. Why do you think I have an oxygen mask on this slide about self-care?
Airplane.
Yes, airplane. Okay, and that is such a hard concept for people, especially women. I think women really, really struggle with this. You feel like you need to take care of everyone. And I can't tell you, like, there's one mom I was talking to, it was just a wreck. And I said, you need to get back in therapy. And she's like, I can't. I'm spending all the money on all my kids that are in therapy, too. And I was like, oh, I don't know how you're going to hold this together if you don't take care of yourself. This was something I had to learn the hard way, was prioritizing self-care. I have a very busy schedule. I have a very busy life. And it's not always easy to fit these things in. But I've learned, and this comes with life and some experience and a few punches in the wrong direction, that if I prioritize this, then everything else runs so much better. For me, exercise is really key. I was, before I started grad school, I did a half Ironman. And back then, I was running marathons and all these things. During grad school, my ability to put brain space into this really intense exercise totally went out the window. And at first I kind of beat myself up about it, but then I realized, hey, you know what? My body needs to still be moving. Motion is lotion, okay? That's really important. You still get endorphin release from just being out there moving, sunshine on my face, all those kinds of things. I've diversified into walking and hiking more, but it's an absolutely critical part of my day. I fortunately have a neighbor who will get up at 5:15 with me on Mondays, Wednesdays, Fridays, and we go walk our little loop, and I have my brain dump, and life is better. But that's something, and I don't care what form of exercise. You can do belly dancing, for all I care. But something. You need to have something that gives you a little endorphin dump and something that keeps you moving. I see a little belly dance conference going on back here. Not sure how I feel about that. You're making plans. Hey, you and me, we've got the henna, the little jingly symbol things. I don't know what those are called. The little dangly, you know what I'm talking about. Ching, ching. Glitter, sequins, the whole bit. Good nutrition. This is critical. And this is another thing that I wasn't super careful about through grad school. The physician that owns the practice that I work in, I've never met a person who is more mindful and fastidious about what he puts in his mouth. He eats so many vegetables, it's ridiculous, like an entire garden's worth in a week. They helped me with a lot of my excess produce out of my garden this year because I just couldn't keep up. And they'd say, hey, have you got more tomatoes? It's like, I just brought you 20 pounds a week ago. No, we ate them all. Okay, good for you. The concept here with good nutrition is garbage in, garbage out. You can't expect your body to run well if you're pouring garbage into it. And this, again, takes some mindfulness and some planning, but your body will thank you. This is going to reduce inflammation. There are a lot of papers that suggest that depression has an inflammation component to it. So if we can reduce our total body inflammation, then that helps our brain function better. Avoiding caffeine, avoiding sugar, avoiding all the extra junk that you really don't know what it is. If you read the label and you're not sure how to pronounce it, then you probably shouldn't eat it. So sleep. This is absolutely critical. And I was telling Brittany before this started, the whole 17 years I was a bedside nurse, I did night shifts. And not only does it have it's an independent risk factor for cancer, but when you're not sleeping at the same time, your body chemistry and that circadian rhythm with all those hormones that are supposed to fluctuate at particular times of day gets totally thrown out of whack. And your body doesn't know what to do with that. And of course that's going to trigger mood disorders. There's a lot of research that even mildly insufficient sleep, so maybe only getting 6 hours a night on average, is very, very strongly linked to depression. And this is something that we can help our teens with. Teens are terrible with sleep hygiene. So if you can teach them to embrace and appreciate a full 8 to 9 hours in their bed, going to bed at the same time every night, waking up at about the same time, then they'll do so much better. That was one of the key things in my son's recovery, was getting him, through the counselor, to embrace self-care and to realize how important and how much better he felt with good sleep. Some other strategies here include mindful meditation, light therapy. I don't know if you've ever seen those little blue lights. There's a specific frequency, light frequency, that can assist with your body in tricking it into feeling like it's getting more sunlight. Those have like, you know, maybe a 5% additive effect. That alone isn't going to take away all of your depression, but it's one of those things that could help. Another thing is educating yourself. Understanding how your body works so that you can be a little bit more mindful about understanding why you feel the way you feel and then reacting appropriately. So you're here tonight. Congratulations. You're educating yourselves. Having some structure in your schedule. I know for myself, when I go through my kind of periodic slump in the winter, I think everyone in Utah is depressed in the winter, that I do much better if on my days off from work, that I have something planned that makes me get up, get ready, and get out of the house. Because if you don't have that, it's really easy to while away the entire day on your couch. And then you feel guilty and worthless because you spent the whole day on your couch, right? Having a way to manage your stress, and boy, if this isn't the ticket to overall wellness, I don't know what is. And some of this comes with time and with wisdom, but learning how to say no to things that aren't good in your life, that's really hard for me. I'm a people pleaser. But I have learned how to say no and realize that not everything's going to be a catastrophe if I can't fulfill everyone's wildest dreams and fantasies. This involved, while I was in grad school, learning how to let go of having a clean house. And not that we live in a filthy pigsty, but I had to learn how to delegate this to my kids and to not go behind them and redo everything that they didn't do quite right. So like if they fold my laundry and my pants are a little bit wonky and the shirt's more wadded up than I like, then you say, thanks for folding the laundry. and you move on. So this is part of stress management, is learning how to delegate and let go of things that you don't have control over or shouldn't have control over. Journaling can be really, really effective, and that, especially if you can do a gratitude journal, so that when you're having those bad days, you can look back and say, I have a lot of good things in my life. Positive self-talk, we're going to talk about that a little bit more on the next slide. And then really being cautious and mindful about self-medicating, either with substances or destructive behavior. This is where just being educated about this and realizing, like, oh, hey, I'm behaving this way because really that's my depression or my anxiety speaking out. I think I should stop that. So stopping that process is valuable. For people that have a lot of anxiety, one thing a lot of my patients have had good success with are weighted blankets, which helps with their sleep and calming, all those kinds of things. So that's another really simple thing that you can implement. This next slide is about self-compassion. I love this concept. This is something that I learned in my own counseling sessions, was this concept of being kind to yourself. Think about your internal dialogue when you're telling yourself, I'm not good enough, nobody likes me, I'm a worthless puddle of slime because I didn't get dinner on the table today and I wasn't able to make myself get out of bed and get showered until like 3 o'clock in the afternoon. If you told that to your friend and said, oh my gosh, I'm a worthless pile of slime, I had a really bad day, my depression was bad and I just really struggled, is your friend going to say, you're right, you are totally a worthless pile of slime? No, they're going to say, I'm sorry you're having a bad day. Things will look up. What can I do to help you feel better? Okay, so this is the process of being really self-aware of what you're telling yourself, labeling it as stinky thinking, getting rid of that, and learning how to be kind to yourself. So instead of feeling like a guilty piece of junk for not doing things today, then you say, today was one of those mental health days, and we all have those sometimes, and tomorrow I'm going to do better. I'm going to call someone up and arrange something so I have a reason to get out of the house, and I'm going to celebrate the little victory that I did get out of bed, and I did shower, even if it was at 3 p.m. Okay, so that's the positive self-talk concept. The person that my counselor referred me to was Kristen Neff. She has some TED Talks, YouTube talks, and this concept of self-kindness is that there's a lot of research that backs up that if you can learn how to be kind to yourself, that is the key to happiness and to resilience, to growing those long legs, right? Taking that pressure off of yourself to be perfect. One of the concepts I like in here is this mindfulness where you need to be open to the pain that you're feeling, but don't horribleize it. Okay? Look at it and say, this is a bad day. This is not... My house didn't explode. You know, everyone's alive. Things are still okay. Give yourself some healthy perspective on what's going on in your life. Also, by being kind to yourself and then externalizing that and sharing it with other people, you'll find out really quickly that lots of other people have similar experiences. And so we can share our burden with other people and lift each other up. Let's talk about how we can be compassionate to other people. This cartoon says, when we break a bone, we say, hey, sign my cast. And when we get a bad cut, it's like, check it out. Here's 12 stitches, and here's the gross cut before they even stitched it on Instagram. Look, look. Everyone's like, vomit, vomit, gross. I don't want to see that. My favorite is when we get the flu, and everyone's like, I puked everywhere, and four of the kids puked, and there's puke, puke, puke. For me, that's really useful from an epidemiologic standpoint, because then when someone calls me and says, hey, is stomach flu going around? I'm like, yeah, four people on Facebook totally post about puking. So yes, it's going around. Super useful, right? But then when if you pop up and say, you know, I'm really struggling with my depression, then all of a sudden everyone flees like you have leprosy, right? Nobody knows what to say. So let's talk about some things not to say. The first one is, don't say, it's all in your head. Technically, a lot of it is in your head, correct? Bad brain chemistry, but it's legitimate. So don't tell someone it's all in your head. You're a totally amazing person. I don't know why you're feeling depressed. You're just making this up, whatever. Or to say, we all go through times like this. So that's kind of taking away the validity of what they're feeling, like buck up, little camper, right? Maybe they're having a short legs moment where they're not feeling very resilient. Look at the bright side. okay, when we were going through our loss with my daughter, we knew before she was born that she wasn't going to live for very long or she'd be stillborn. And very well-meaning people came up to us and said things like, well, at least you have two other kids. You're right. I do have two other kids. That does not take away the pain that I'm feeling by losing my third kid. So while I appreciate their attempts to help me look at the bright side, it was not acknowledging the pain that I was feeling. You have so much to live for. Why do you want to die? Just remember that these people are in a position where their perception of reality is really altered. And there's gentler ways to help them see their value and their worth than to say, like, what's your problem? Why do you want to die? I can't do anything about your situation. The reality is that you can. Just offering some support and kindness can go a long way. Just snap out of it. What's wrong with you? And shouldn't you be better by now? Do you tell someone with diabetes? Shouldn't you be better by now? Shouldn't you have, like, fixed that whole little insulin problem? You know, your pancreas pooped out. I get that, but shouldn't you be over that by now? There's no timeline on this. We all go through kind of ebbs and flows in life. So there's periods of time where you're more prone to depression or you have those shorter legs and other times where you're not. So yeah, sometimes people outgrow this, but for other people, it's a lifelong process. Here's another example of that. We have these two cartoons. I get that you have food poisoning and all, but could you at least make an effort for the rest of us? Or the person with his arm cut off. I think if you just changed your frame of mind, you'd probably feel better about this. You know, they have cool prosthetics. So let's talk about the things that you can do for people who are feeling depressed. The first thing is to be willing to open that conversation. And this is part of the training that we do in the youth suicide prevention training is we actually do a practice conversation where you have to get past the, hey, how's it going? Okay, and then move on. Because it's really easy to just slide past that. When you have a conversation with someone, you're like, how are things going? Fine. Isn't that the worst answer ever? If your kids tell you fine, are you like, okay, wait. What do you mean by fine? Really? Are you really fine? Or is this, you know, I need some more adjectives. I need some more descriptors here. And so the first thing is being brave about opening that conversation because chances are that they are wishing someone would reach out to them. And as soon as you open that door, it's going to be a tremendous relief to them. So don't be afraid to ask them. This is a pretty non-confrontational and kind way to ask it, the way it's phrased here on the slide where it says, I wanted to check in with you because you've seemed pretty down lately. Like, I've noticed this. I just want to see how you're doing. I really care. Make sure you have time to actually listen to hear what they have to say if you're going to open that conversation. This is not the conversation to have in passing at the grocery store with carts whizzing around you and everything else. The next thing is to validate the way they're feeling. I'm so sorry you're feeling this way. The next one is to be patient. I'm here for you. A lot of times when people are in a really super depressed or really anxious state, it takes a lot of persistence to get through the shell they've built around them for them to allow you to help them. And so don't be afraid to be persistent and just let them know, keep checking in. Even if they say, today, no, I'm fine, but like I'm still worried, keep checking in. And they'll appreciate that. Supporting them and letting them know that they won't always feel this way. Because when you're down in that deep, dark pit, you can feel like you're never going to see sunlight again. So having someone help them realize this is not forever and I'm here to right beside you until you feel better, that's a big thing. What do you think might help you feel better? That's a really hard question for those people to answer. This is like when someone has something bad happen and people say, let me know if there's anything I can do to help. Okay, who are you going to call? How many times have you reached out to someone who posted on Facebook or whatever when you posted your tragedy and they're like, let me know if you need anything? Versus if someone came to your house or called you up and said, I know that you're going through a lot right now and I'd really like to help. I'd like to bring you in dinner. Can I bring it in Tuesday or Wednesday? Okay, which one are you going to actually respond to? Someone who has a concrete way to help you. And that's one of the things, the examples I put here on the slide is, can I help you make an appointment or can I drive you somewhere? Turns out people that are profoundly depressed or anxious are not very good behind the steering wheel. So you can help save a lot of lives by offering to take them to an appointment. Also, it's really, really hard for people to take that leap to schedule an appointment. And so if you'll just extend the kindness of helping arrange an appointment and maybe making sure they get there, the first patient that I saw, I actually saw him before I officially started my job at this clinic. He was a friend of mine that reached out to me that was in the middle of a divorce and was just acutely suicidal, feeling terrible. And I was like, oh, this can't wait for 3 more weeks until I officially start at the clinic. So I made the appointment for him, and I went to the appointment with him, with my physician that owns the clinic, and got him started on treatment. And then I followed up, and he's doing much, much better now. But he just couldn't, he didn't have it in him to reach out of his cave to make that phone call and explain to the secretary on the other end, I feel like I'm going to kill myself. That's a really hard thing. So this is something, a concrete thing you can do to help people. I love this illustration of sympathy versus empathy. Have any of you guys seen the little Brené Brown cartoon? It's about 3 minutes long, about sympathy versus empathy. You should look it up. It's a really good one. It shows this little thing. The depiction is this person down in the pit that's having a really hard time. And the sympathetic person stands at the top and says, boy, that sure looks bad down there. I'm sorry that you're in the hole. And then they walk away. The empathetic person crawls down in the hole with them, has the bucket of Ben and Jerry's, and sits down next to him and embraces that pain and sees if there's a way they can help ease that. Okay, that's the difference between sympathy and empathy. I have this slide on phrases for calming an anxious child. Any of you guys have anxious kids in your life? Brittany's laughing. Yes, there's anxious kids. I see a lot of anxious kids in clinic. One of the conditions that we treat is called PANDAS, and it's a severe OCD and anxiety that's triggered by a strep infection. So these are kids that are normal, fine, and then all of a sudden they get an infection, and it might not even be strep. The strep may have triggered some antibodies in their brain, you know, in the past, and then they get a cold and it flares their immune system back up again. So we see a lot of anxious kids in our clinic. So I really love these phrases, and when I send the slides to Brittany, there's a little blog reference there at the bottom for the more fleshed out version of this. This is just the summary of the things you can tell them. When you have a kid that's really anxious and acting out because they can't figure out how to get out of their own head, these are some things you can say to them. You can say, I am here. You can say, tell me about it. Because then that forces them to put into words what's bothering them. And that's hard. If they can't do that, then you can ask them to draw it. And sometimes that's a way for them to do it in a safer way or an easier way when they can't put the words on it. How big is your worry? And this is something that teaches your kids to quantify when they're having a total meltdown over a broken crayon. And you're like, come on, it's a broken crayon. Really? So teaching them how to quantify this, is this a little worry or is this a really big worry? Then that helps them learn over time what's worth a meltdown and what's not. A broken crayon's not worth a meltdown. But that's a learning process for them. They have immature brains. What do you want to tell your worry? And I love this one because if they're really worried about a monster under their bed or going to school, then they can tell that monster, I want to tell that monster to go away and not come back. So it gives them a power to verbalize these things out loud to help overcome that. Let's change the ending. This is a good one to help them redirect the horribleizing that's going on in their head. Their inevitable sense of doom, then you can help them change the ending. It can be something silly. So it's like, I'm afraid I'm going to go to the doctor and I'm going to get a shot and it's going to hurt real bad. And then you're like, and then a frog will jump out of the corner and it'll be super silly and the doctor's really a princess, you know, whatever. So you make some silly ending so it adds some levity to that and helps them understand that not everything is awful. What else do you know about fill in the blank? This is good for kids that have a specific phobia, like spiders or something. Give them the opportunity to research that thing that they're afraid of, and then it makes it less scary because now they have more power, more control over it. And then you ask them about what calming strategies, after you've worked on some of these, what things do you think you could do to help yourself calm down? And so that empowers them to use the tools that you've already worked on. It's scary, and so like I had a kid I had to draw blood on, and he was screaming, it's scary, I'm so scared, I'm so scared. And so he said, it's scary and it's going to be over quickly. So what we did was set a timer and said, when this timer is all done, then we're going to be all done with this. We're going to have everything we need, and then you'll get to see the blood from your body. And he thought that was super cool. And as soon as we were done, he's like, look, there's blood in my body. And he thought it was amazing. But we had to get over the, it's super scary. We had to give him something positive at the end and a finite end to it. I can't wait to hear about it. That's a good one for kids that are really scared of going to school or going to church or being separated from you. And you say, I know it's scary, but I really can't wait to hear about all the things you did while you were away from me. So remember all the really fun and cool and nifty things that you did so you can tell me all about it when you get home. What do you need from me? And for some kids, that might be space and time alone in their rooms, or it might be a cuddle, or it might need to be under blankets, under the weighted blanket for a while. You are safe, and this feeling will pass. Both of those things are really important reassurances for kids that have a lot of anxiety. Let's talk about some spiritual care. I left this Mormon quote in for you. Brittany told me you wouldn't be offended, so hopefully you're not. It's a good one. Elder Holland, I suspect that he has struggled with mental health issues himself because this is something he's spoken about a lot. There's one particular conference talk that he gave that's called Like a Broken Vessel, where it talks a lot about the spiritual aspects of healing from mental health disorders. This quote says, "Trust in God, hold on in his love, and know that one day the dawn will break brightly and all the shadows of mortality will flee. Though we may feel that we are like a broken vessel, as the psalmist says, we must remember that vessels in the hands of the divine potter. Broken minds can be healed just the way broken bones and broken hearts are healed. And while God is at work making those repairs, the rest of us can help by being merciful, non-judgmental, and kind." One of the things that I think is hard in a spiritual sense is that sometimes it's easy to beat yourself up and feel like if I had a little more faith and I prayed more, then maybe I wouldn't feel depressed. Like here we are in the most privileged country in the entire world, everything at our disposal, the world is our oyster, we can do anything we want. And so you feel this guilt and this, crushing like separation from God that goes along with that. I just want you to be mindful that spiritual care is part of the recovery process, and be patient with yourself. At least as a Mormon, and I don't know how the nuances are in your congregation, but we have so much pressure. Like, you should be doing daily scripture study and family home evening and, all these things. The list grows and grows and grows, and it can feel just crushing. Be gentle with yourselves in this pursuit of perfection, and do baby steps, little steps, and pat yourself on the back for those. Just like, I like to think of this in terms of like teeth brushing. Like, say if you're like, I really need to be reading my scriptures every day, but I missed today. If you missed your teeth brushing for a day, would you say, that's it? I guess that's the end of tooth brushing for me. I missed a couple of days, right? I'm gonna let my teeth rot out of my head. No, we pick ourselves up by the bootstraps. We do a little redemption flossing before we go to the dentist, right? And you start brushing your teeth again. Just keep on trucking on, one foot in front of the other. Don't give up. Don't you quit. You keep walking and you keep trying. There's help and happiness ahead. And I think a lot of times there's periods in our life where it feels like one foot in front of the other, but there's always something good at the other end of it. I love this scripture in Matthew 28:20, that says, I am with you always. You're never alone in this process. And just remember that any of the suffering that you feel, your Savior has felt that same suffering, and he's very mindful of it, and he wants to carry you through that. Some quick resources here at the end. If you have a hard time just being mindful and meditating on your own, that takes a lot of practice, by the way. I can never get my brain to shut off. So there's some apps out there. There's a lot of free apps. These are just two that I put up here that can be useful, that can help guide you through some meditation. Aura, and then Stop, Think, and Breathe. They usually have some free ones, and then you can subscribe and pay for more. But those can really help, especially for people that have a hard time with a sleep initiation, that if you can work that into your bedtime routine to have something that helps dump your brain and calm it down, that's good. These are a few books I recommend. We have the When My Worries Get Too Big. That's a really good one for kids. It helps them learn to identify their feelings and figure out what's making them feel weird and how they can do something about that. Then we have the Anxiety and Phobia Workbook and What to Say When You Talk to Yourself. Both of those are really excellent kind of workbooks that, I don't want to say it's a therapist in a book, but that's kind of, it's self-help oriented. It doesn't replace a counselor, but it's a good place to start, and it's a good thing to work on at home. Now I want to talk about these suicide resources. Here in Utah, we have the Safe Utah app. Are you guys familiar with that? OK, Okay, that saved the life of a kid in my neighborhood recently. It's an app that allows you to either call or text a social worker up at uni, and any time of the day or night, and they are busy 24/7. And in this kid's case, super distressed in the middle of the night, and his mom didn't know what else to do, she whipped out her phone and started texting the social worker, and they conversed back and forth for about 2 or 3 hours, kind of got him calmed down, and then had an appointment from first thing the next morning, and then they did a direct admit to uni for 9 days after that. So it's one good way to access resources. You can also, if you don't want to download the app on your phone, you can teach people that they can text START to 741-741, and it gets to the same people. So you can call on the phone, you can text, you can use the app, same social workers on the other end of it. Unfortunately, there's no such thing as a mental health ER here in Utah. So if someone's acutely in crisis, actively in a position where you're afraid they're going to hurt themselves, you just have to take them to the regular ER. Crisis worker will come and evaluate them once they're medically stable and decide if they're stable enough to go home with a safety contract and someone to watch over them with close follow-up in the community, or whether they need to be admitted for observation and for treatment. I wish there was a better way to access that. But it's common. If you talk to any firefighter, they'll tell you that a significant portion of the calls they go on every day are mental health related. I have some other resources in here that you'll be able to read once you get the slides. These are just like some mindfulness, meditation kind of things, and also the National Association of the Mentally Ill has a lot of good, just basic mental health question answers. And last of all, I want to just finish up with a reminder that you're worth it. It's worth it to take care of yourself, and your spiritual and mental and emotional health are closely intertwined. It's like a three-legged stool. If one of them's off balance, you're going to be falling off on your butt. So you're worth it. Take good care of yourself and take good care of the people around you. And that's the end of my presentation.
Thanks for listening to Project Zion Podcast. Subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcast, Stitcher, or whatever podcast streaming service you use. And while you are there, give us a 5-star rating. Project Zion Podcast is sponsored by Latter-day Seeker Ministries of Community of Christ. The views and opinions expressed in this episode are of those speaking and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Latter-day Seeker Ministries or Community of Christ. The music has been graciously provided by Dave Hines.